Sitting opposite me is a bloke who likes tilting at windmills. He doesn't want to tilt at electrically generating windmills, but his political timing couldn't be worse for his new book, Sustainable Energy Solutions for Climate Change, because we have a government which is still in denial and will either, as I said, ignore the book or perhaps actively deride it. I, on the other hand, am delighted that he's written it and welcoming to our little program, Mark is Associate Professor and Deputy Director of the Institute of Environmental Studies at the University of New South Wales. His new book looks at the science of climate change, the technology behind renewable energy sources, the economics of moving from our current polluting systems to others that are more sustainable, and the policies that need to be put in place to enable this change to this transition to take place. Do you feel that your book is going to be passed from hand to hand around the cabinet room, Mark?
Oh, hardly, Philip. The book is for concerned members of the public. It's to try and help build community awareness that we now have the technologies to actually run many countries entirely on renewable energy used efficiently. And we know many of the policies that need to be implemented to make that transition. So my feeling is there's an enormous need to build organised community pressure to put that pressure on decision makers.
One wishes that it was going our way, if I might use the royal plural for us, but at the same time, of course, the attacks on climate change science as being nonsensical is nothing less than frenzied. So I suppose we're in an uneasy time. Mark, tell me about your modelling.
Well, I'm part of a group at the University of New South Wales that has been trying to answer the question, how reliable is a 100% renewable electricity system in Australia? And what would it cost? And so thanks to a brilliant PhD student, Ben Elliston, and Ian McGill and myself, we've been doing hour-by-hour computer simulations of electricity supply and demand, where all the supply comes from renewable sources which are commercially available. And
and let me just introduce another notion at this point, because I've done a quick read, and also there's a lot of technologies which are becoming feasible, becoming commercially available.
That's right. So renewable energy technologies, like many other technologies, exist at different stages of maturity. So the fully commercial technologies are very mature: onshore wind power, solar photovoltaic modules. In early commercialization, we have concentrated solar thermal power with thermal storage, commercially available. And of course, we have existing hydro, which is very commercial. And then we have...
There's hot rocks, for example, ticking away in the background.
Well, that's right, but that technology...
Biochar, a whole lot of stuff that's on the horizon.
Yes, but what we've shown with our modelling is that although the renewable energy system will become even more diverse in the future, we could run our national electricity market
now
on existing commercially available renewable technologies, provided, of course, they were scaled up. We could do it with the same reliability as the existing polluting system.
It's true, isn't it, that we've got a huge solar energy resource west of the Great Dividing Range and a substantial wind energy potential in the southern regions.
That's right. And in fact, our optimal mix economically is nearly 50% wind, because that's the cheapest, maybe 20% solar photovoltaics, 20% concentrated solar thermal, existing hydro, which is quite small, and just a small amount of energy to fill some gaps that occur often on winter evenings after overcast days which haven't been very windy, and we would use gas turbines running on renewable gas or renewable liquids for those very few short periods.
Now, Mark, what happens in peak periods like the recent heat waves? The sun's beating down, of course, and there's been a fair bit of wind associated with it, but can it handle the peak periods?
Well, it is handling both in the modelling that we've been doing and in the real world. So as you know, we've had a terrible heat wave in South Australia, which was really equivalent to one that had enormous peaks in electricity demand due to air conditioning 10 years ago. But this time, because solar has been rapidly growing in South Australia, the peaks were actually reduced by almost 5%, and yet the population and the population of air conditioners has increased dramatically in the past 10 years.
I guess that air conditioners, like most electrical appliances, are also rather better designed lately.
Well, the good ones are very good, but unfortunately people tend to buy the cheap ones which come in from China, and some of them are rubbish, and they use an enormous amount of electricity. They're very inefficient. So we have this mixture of high quality and rubbish air conditioners, and that's really what's predominantly responsible for the increase in electricity prices around Australia. It's basically the utilities are trying to provide the infrastructure, the power lines,
and immediately charge it on.
And definitely charge it on. And it's sort of ironic because thanks to the large amount of wind power, particularly in South Australia, where it's 30% now of annual energy, almost 30%, the wholesale price of electricity in South Australia has declined, but that reduction is not being passed on to the retail price for ordinary domestic consumers.
Talking to Mark Diesendorf about his book, Sustainable Energy Solutions for Climate Change, publisher New South Books. Okay, everything you've just said has been vociferously denied by the fossil fuel lobby, who took great satisfaction in saying renewable energy sources couldn't cope with that demand, particularly in South Australia.
Well, yes, our Prime Minister's even said recently that the sun doesn't shine at night.
To give him credit, there's some truth in that.
It's a true statement, but it's very misleading because we would supply the electricity system with a mixture of different sources which balance each other out. But certainly the fossil fuel industry, as you've mentioned, is now feeling very threatened by renewable energy because for some consumers now, it is actually cheaper to put solar photovoltaics on their roofs than to buy electricity from the grid. And in fact, the demand for electricity from the grid has been decreasing for the past several years, partly as a result of solar photovoltaics, partly as a result of people responding to the price increases in electricity by reducing their demand and cutting out on energy wastage.
As I drive home tonight after the program, I will be going through the vast mining areas, you know, pretty much from Cessnock to home. The skies will glow with the 24/7 production, digging up of coal. I'll pass between the great coal-generating power stations with their immense chimneys pouring out what they insist is only steam. One trusts that that's true. And the fossil fuel lobby will not take what you're proposing lying down. It will continue to pour money into the ears of the denialists through various front organisations. Is there any sign that you might be winning that fight?
Well, I think in the long run we will win simply because of the economics of renewables. They're improving steadily, not only solar photovoltaics, but wind power as well. And so will concentrated solar thermal as the market increases, although in Australia it's not going to increase much there. So in the long run, I do feel confident that Australia will be running predominantly on renewables, but I don't feel so confident that I will actually see it. And I do feel...
And you're only a young bloke.
Well, it's all relative, isn't it?
It is. Okay. So I think we've dealt with the base load fallacy in your use of logic to refute it. But you also make another point that no, there is no such thing as a perfectly reliable power station or electricity generating system, as some nuclear power problems lately have demonstrated.
Well, nuclear and also coal, because during the heatwave in South Australia, one of the Victorian coal-fired power stations broke down, and we could rightly call coal power intermittent.
You had nothing to do with that, I trust.
No. I'm perfectly innocent in that regard, although my feelings were rather amused at the result. In terms of nuclear, I mean, we have just seen the British government offering the nuclear industry for a new nuclear power station a guaranteed price equivalent to 17 cents Australian for each unit of electricity. Now, that's double the price of wind power right now in the UK.
And yet, people, valiant fighters for truth and justice like James Lovelock has shifted his position, and others have, quite dramatically, saying it's perhaps not as bad as we think it is, and some of them even suggest it's one of the least worst alternatives.
Well, I think that they've been conned, really, by the propaganda. I mean, I wasn't originally opposed to nuclear power. I was a physicist. But the more I looked at it, the more I could see that it's extremely dangerous, even after 50 years. And we saw that with Fukushima and with the countries that have used so-called peaceful nuclear power to covertly develop nuclear weapons. It's now incredibly expensive, as we see from the British experience. It's a very slow technology to build. So, you know, it really can't make much of an additional contribution over the next few decades. And ultimately, it's a significant emitter of carbon dioxide if you look at the life cycle emissions, as the uranium, high-grade uranium, is running out. And as you have to dig up lower and lower grade uranium using fossil fuels, you increase the carbon dioxide emissions of that whole nuclear fuel cycle.
Okay, let's go back to the economics of renewables. If they're that good, they make it a hell of an investment. Do financial investors see this?
They're starting to see it, yes. There are some that are now moving into it. But we now have a mixture in the investment area between those that are aware of the potential of the most advanced renewable technologies, and also some of them are aware that it's becoming financially very risky to have investments heavily dependent on fossil fuels, particularly coal. It's a very risky investment. For example, if we had a...
And politically an increasingly unpopular one.
Well, that's right, in many parts of the world. So I think on the investment side, also more and more people are looking for ethical investments which do not contain direct investments in coal and other fossil fuels. And, you know, there are a number of very fine superannuation funds now. And in fact, I'm just in the process of trying to shift some of my superannuation into an ethical investment fund rather than supporting the coal industry and the oil industry and so on.
This is a change in tactics which I welcome, and I hope to hell it works. Given that large-scale renewable energy production and use is highly dependent on the policies of national and state governments, where do you see glimmers of hope in this country?
Well, most of the glimmers of hope, or actually quite large windows of hope, come from overseas. So we look at the examples of Denmark, Germany, Scotland.
Just stop on Denmark. Yes. Denmark, as I understand it, does very well out of wind power.
It's generating now over 30% of its electricity from wind. By 2020, it'll be generating half its electricity from wind. And by 2035, and this is official government program endorsed by both major parties, it will be totally renewable for electricity and heat. And by 2050, it's going to try to be totally renewable on transport. So there's a country that is also actually doing very well economically out of it, because it's a huge export industry now.
You're right that over the past 50 years, many social movements, peace, feminist, environmental, social justice, consumer protection, have emerged and or become stronger, acquiring insight and skills to challenge ruthless power structures and culturally embedded injustice. Culturally embedded injustice.
Well, yes. I mean, what you have is very powerful vested interests trying to force the community to stay tied to 19th and early 20th century technologies. As Senator Christine Mills said, we're now in the middle of a fight between the past and the future. The political battle isn't between Labor and the Coalition primarily in this area. It is between the past and the future, between fossil fuels on one hand and energy efficiency and renewable energy on the other. And I think this will prove to be one of the big global political battles of this century. It's already coming, you know, shaping up to be that.
What's happening in Germany, where an extraordinarily courageous decision to get out of nukes was recently introduced? What's the politics in Germany?
Well, following Fukushima, Angela Merkel found it really impossible to maintain a pro-nuclear position, which it had previously. So she's a very shrewd politician, and she moved to phase out nuclear power by 2022. And the interesting thing that's happening is that this has not resulted in an increase in fossil fuel burning. It has increased a lot. There's been a lot of increase in renewables, in energy efficiency, and there's been some slight reduction in German exports of electricity to the rest of Europe. But it's going well, and Germany has to be acknowledged as, because of its initial bravery, really, in a country that doesn't have much sunshine, in going to back solar energy. It has succeeded in
being... And the sun doesn't shine at night.
That's right. And yet the Germans brought the price of solar photovoltaics down so rapidly that then the Chinese jumped on the bandwagon, and now they are trying very hard to take over the solar manufacturing area and export.
We've done a huge amount on China's response to all of this, and of course China, on the one hand, is an immense polluter, but on the other hand, they do seem to be using centralised planning to try and tackle it. Anything in China that you find encouraging?
Well, they're actually using standard economic incentives to build wind power and solar power. So they have what we call feed-in tariffs, where a premium price is paid for feeding renewable energy into the grid. And that was so successful that from 2005, every year they succeeded in doubling their wind power capacity for 5 years
every
running.
Every year,
100% growth rate from 2005 for 5 years. Now, obviously, you can't keep up 100% growth rate forever, but they've done fantastically. So they're the world leaders now in wind turbine capacity installed. They are the biggest manufacturer of solar photovoltaic modules in the world. And it goes on. They're the biggest manufacturer.
No wonder you're looking quite cheerful.
Well,
I was talking to Shapiro earlier in the program about the way Fox News in particular is insisting that the huge problems of snow and ultra coldness demonstrates, proves beyond doubt that global warming's nonsensical. On the other hand, we hear Obama finally using the term climate change in his public oratory. Anything happening in the United States?
Well, the best things that are happening in the United States are happening at the state level. So California is showing the lead, is installing a lot of solar, and some of the other states are also coming to the party. Yes, Obama's words are encouraging, but he's left it very late. He did put some resources during the financial crisis into renewable energy. And
copped it for doing it.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And, yes, I mean, if only the US federal scene improved. I think if they actually became serious about climate response, I think we'd see another huge jump in China as well. Because talking to colleagues of mine in China, you know, they say in China we have the major group which wants to follow the United States, only do bigger and better, whether it's pollution or what. And we have a minority group that feels that China can leapfrog over the mistakes that the West has made and go to a much cleaner set of technologies. And there's actually a lot to show for that. But if
I suddenly feel very sorry for a windmill in China having to turn its blades in air, which is so totally and utterly corrupted by pollution.
Well, if they reduce the pollution, their solar energy output would increase quite dramatically too. So these things are very much linked together. And the Chinese now, even the government is very disturbed about the huge pollution in Beijing and other cities. So mainly as a result of air pollution, they are really running a very massive program for renewable energy. Admittedly, they're also trying to grow nuclear power, which is very tiny in China at present. It's only less than 2.5% of their electricity. And as you said before, they're still also growing coal-fired power stations, but trying to phase out the smaller, more polluting stations.
And all that stuff about carbon capture from coal-fired stations has turned out to be, to say the least, fictional.
Well, the technology's turned out to be much more complex and potentially expensive than the promotions suggested. And in fact, we've just done some computer simulations comparing 100% renewable energy with hypothetical coal power with carbon capture and storage with some peak load gas. And of course, we don't know what carbon capture and storage is going to cost. So we took a wide range of different costs, a wide range of carbon prices and so on. And what we found was that only in a few very special cases does it look like coal with carbon capture and storage could ever compete with 100% renewables. And that's very exciting. It means that really, if one goes for a low carbon future, no form of fossil fuels can actually compete economically, let alone environmentally.
You're forgetting the miracles of fracking.
The miracles of fracking. Well, yes, if that continues, there'll be a lot of gas. But you see, in Australia, gas prices in the past have been very low. And now that fracking is occurring, most of that gas is being exported, and that's driving up the price of gas to world prices here.
Yeah.
So it does look like gas isn't going to be able to compete with renewables either. If the price of gas keeps going up to export prices, gas will be out of the mix, except for small contributions like gas turbines for peaking purposes.
We haven't really discussed the impact of all these technologies on water, but that's another huge issue. And, of course, that's the big complaint about fracking, is what it might do to water, particularly to the destruction or pollution of aquifers. Do you do much modelling on water?
Well, not our group, but there are other groups at our university that do. But one thing I can say is that wind power and solar photovoltaics actually use no water during operation.
Unlike Dorothy Dixert. Yes.
Yes, that was a good one.
Yeah. So the fracking thing is about the only thing where I see a remarkable, almost panoramic hostility to a new technology, which is uniting more communities than it's dividing.
Well, I think that's a very important part. Ultimately, will be a very important part of the campaign for climate action, because it's these pressure points like the fracking, like new coal mines, and simply like the lack of adequate public transport in cities and the growing congestion in cities like Sydney, these can form pressure points that, if people organise, they can form a united campaign based around these pressure points to try and put serious political pressure on governments, whichever complexion that government is, to take some genuine action instead of token action. So I really see issues like fracking as playing a vital role in mobilising a much wider cross-section of the community.
And educating people on how to be good fighters.
That's right. And also there's a growing involvement of the public health community now in this whole issue, because the health implications of fossil fuels are really quite severe and they've been played down in the past. And we're now starting to get good epidemiological data from some parts of the world that really show that, you know, that sticking with fossil fuels has a whole range of health impacts in addition to the climate impacts.
Mark, I'm awfully glad you've written the book, and thanks for coming in. Mark Diesendorf, Associate Professor and Deputy Director of the Institute of Environmental Studies, University of New South Wales, and his book, Sustainable Energy Solutions for Climate Change, is published by New South Books. On our next, more from our series we're calling Election Watch. Indonesians go to the polls in April to elect their next parliament, in July to elect their next president, and in Tokyo this very Sunday, the very important election of the governor takes place. And staying in Japan, I'll be talking to Richard Lloyd Parry about the ghosts of the tsunami. Look, thanks for listening. Thanks, Mark. And I look forward to seeing you all again in 24 hours.